The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by Exchange Wire.
Hello and welcome to this week's Mad Tech Podcast from Exchange Wire, bringing you the latest from the worlds of marketing, media and commerce. I'm John Still, Exchange Wire's Head of Content, and I'm thrilled to be joined today by someone we've been wanting to have on the pod for some time, Penelope Siraj, Principal Consultant at R3 in Singapore. Penelope, welcome.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and great. I'm glad that we found some time to do this.
Yeah, thrilled to have you. I think we've been trying for most of the year, so nice to get this in December and finally have you on board. I am also delighted to be joined, hot on the heels of ATS Tokyo, by Exchange Wire's jet setting CEO, Rachel Smith. Rachel, welcome wherever you are in the world.
Thank you very much. Yes, I made a joke with a friend earlier this morning that I have a feeling that I'm on Santa's naughty list this year for a bit too much travel because it has been a little bit crazy. But it was great to revisit Japan for the first time after a couple of years.
Cool. Well, I know it was a very successful event. But yeah, speaking of carbon, I'll go straight on to our first story.
Just to further dig the guilt in there. Go on,
yeah,
John.
Yeah, just, we'll talk about carbon footprints. Anyway, Unilever are to be investigated in the UK over claims of greenwashing. The UK's Competition and Markets Authority are looking into Unilever, the owner of Dove, Marmite, countless other brands, over concerns that the company is misleading consumers with green claims on its products. The watchdog suggested that Unilever is overstating how green certain products are through the use of vague environmental claims and unclear statements around recyclability. Unilever have said they'll cooperate with the investigation, but are surprised and disappointed by these claims. Sustainability it's become more and more important over the last few years. It is going to be a defining issue of 2024. Brands are still in trouble for this kind of thing. Penelope, how careful do advertisers really need to be now with their green claims?
I think careful is one thing that, and how careful I think is a spectrum, especially depending on the vertical, the category that advertisers are in. I think it's not just one kind of answer. But I think for especially advertisers or brands that work across mass markets, there's an opportunity to be a lot more responsible about what the green claims mean. Precisely because it has so much attention and consumers maybe are starting to come around to making purchasing decisions based on those claims, aside from, you know, the typical decisions on whether I can afford the thing, whether I need the thing. But now if this is overlaid into the purchasing decision, then it should be a little bit more responsible, I feel, for the products which touch a lot of people's lives.
Yeah. And it's like you say, this is now baked in choosing what products you use, particularly with traditionally harmful chemical stuff, cleaning products, which are it's Unilever's bread and butter. Rachel, how do you think, how can Unilever approach this responsibility? How should brands really be considering their sustainability and their advertising around that in particular?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, part of the sort of statement that Unilever released was that they were, going to be cooperating with the investigation and that they felt that some of the claims that were being made by the CMA or that the CMA said they would be investigating around product packaging and messaging were unfounded and that they feel confident that they can substantiate anything that they have attached to marketing messages for their products. So, and Unilever is an enormous multinational FMCG. So I can't imagine they've said that lightly. So I think the devil might be in the detail here. I think in a general sense, I absolutely agree with Penelope. Now more than ever is the time that brands need to be taking their environmental sustainability claims very seriously and be very careful about what they are promising to do and not to do, because consumers are watching now more than ever before. And as you've just said, John, they're making purchasing decisions on the basis of what they think, of the integrity of a product. But I just feel as though, so far what I've seen in Unilever's response is very much focused on the validity of what they've said, about particular products. So if they have pointed to packaging, the sort of details of what type of packaging their products are produced in. They claim that's in order to enable people to make decisions about how to recycle the packaging, etc. So it will be really interesting to see what the CMA's investigations turn up here. I think there's a larger issue, though, which is that Unilever have definitely put themselves forward as a sort of, well, they're positioning themselves as a global leader on issues such as sustainability. And I still think that they're not doing anywhere near enough, as do a lot of other commentators, industry commentators, to actually overall reduce their reliance on things like single-use plastics. And that's where I think they could have a massive impact. So I sort of feel like this is a super interesting story. The other thing that I thought about it when I was reading it as well was that it reminds me of all the things that marketers do to sell, claim to sell products. You know, these would not be the first pool of marketers that have been brought into kind of competition spotlight on the basis of the facts that they state about their products. And I'm thinking about things like food packaging, where products are claiming to be fat-free or, you know, have a contribution to healthy eating. There's been a huge focus on those sorts of products in the UK, I'm sure in other global markets in the last couple of years. At the end of the day, we all know, having worked in this industry for a while, that there is a fine line between marketing things and being factually accurate about what your products contain. So I think there's a mixture of things going on here. I think absolutely Unilever need to make sure that they are telling the truth because consumers will just go elsewhere. But I also am interested to understand whether the CMA and for that matter, any other authorities are focusing on the right things here. Is it about the claims that they're making, you know, associated with packaging and the way their products are produced, or rather should they be being, you know, pressured to focus on reducing their use of single-use plastics across the board?
Yep. I think it's kind of somewhere there, right? Like greenwashing is it active misinformation that's being passed around and used as a promotional tactic? Or is it kind, is it, you know, which is, you know, on the scale of exaggeration to hyperbole, it's somewhere there, because there is fact. And like a lot of other regulated industries, what has come about is, you know, either guidelines on how do you represent this information, which can sometimes be complicated and nuanced and, you know, technical. And how do you make it such that the bigger issue is as the average consumer consumes products or make choices, that they are making kind of choices that they understand and not from some really, really small detail, which is important. It's all important. And it is maybe based on fact, but it could be only a small part of the entire product. And it doesn't mean that all parts of the product or the manufacturing process are necessarily green or eco-friendly or, you know, tie in with the consumer's personal beliefs. So I think maybe it's somewhere in exactly what you, I think Rachel said, something along the lines of what is the CMA really going to focus on as the actual, you know, what is really the problem with greenwashing and how it's represented to consumers in products that, you know, big CPG brand marketing.
You're both dead on in terms of the nuance of what greenwashing really is and what counts as greenwashing. But yeah, Rachel, carry on. Sorry.
I was just going to say, because at the end of the day, I think that consumers, there's a brand element to this. So how are you pushing and promoting your brand, which is, I expect what some of Unilever are doing, making statements about things that they feel they can substantiate regarding environmental sustainability, and then using some imagery and some packaging to put across, you know, a brand positioning that makes their products look eco-friendly. And that is partly about brand building. And then there's about what you actually do. So, and I was just also thinking about this as I was going through reading the article. If I wanted to purchase an eco-friendly dishwashing liquid, I'm not sure I'd go to the big CPG brands to find that. I'd actually look for alternative brands because I've got this association with alternative brands being more eco-friendly. Now, that could be completely wrong because I'm not spending enough time looking at the detail of the products I'm purchasing or, you know, the validity of their supply chain when it comes to to making environmental claims. But I imagine that Unilever, what part of what Unilever are trying to do is put themselves back into that category, you know, that we might be an enormous FMCG brand and we might have these, you know, much loved household brands that have been produced in a very traditional way for a long time. But now we want to signal to you that we are producing these products in a different way. And if that's the case, then that is, like you said, Penelope, it's a complex message that needs to get across in a nuanced way. And I wonder as well if this is going to be a sort of a somewhat of a period of, you know, a sort of an inflection point in history where there is much more of a focus on the way brands package and promote their goods regarding particularly environmental sustainability. And if it is an inflection point and a turning point, wouldn't it be great if that carried over into other issues as well, such as food packaging and the claims that they might make about whether products are healthy and good for you, et cetera?
Yeah, it's something, you know, it's a huge issue for the industry for the coming year, sustainability and how we position ourselves as an industry in terms of sustainability are going to dominate a lot of questions. But yeah, an interesting one to see whether this has teeth really for the CMA, whether they want to carry it through, what the results of the investigation are. We will come back to it as it unfolds. Next story, I think. More legal wrangling. Good. Jury has decided that Google has an illegal monopoly in the App Store fight. Epic has secured a win in its lawsuits against Google, which has alleged that Google turned its Google Play App Store and Google Play billing service into an illegal monopoly. The jury agreed that Google has monopoly power in the Android app distribution market and in-app billing service markets, and that the tech giant has done anti-competitive things in those markets, which has injured Epic by the behavior. The tie-in between Google's Play App Store and its Play billing payment has also been deemed illegal. I've said Google a lot of times in that paragraph. In short, Epic have won a part of their legal battle over Google's monopoly. Another week, another lawsuit. Rachel, do you think this one's going to stick?
This is the thing. I mean, surprise, surprise, Google are found to have been undertaking anti-competition practices. Well, blow me down. Like, you know, this is absolutely no surprise whatsoever. It's also, like you allude to there, John, it's the first step in what could be actually a really long legal battle. So Epic have won this claim in a court in California, I believe. But Google have already come out saying that they will be appealing the ruling, which is not surprising at all. And so let's see where this actually goes. I was thinking about this in the context of a conversation I was having with Kira on the other day about Google. One can imagine where that conversation went. but unusually, he was actually defending them as a business and saying that he'd been speaking to a senior Google exec, I think, in the UK, who was, you know, not necessarily defending their position in terms of dominance in ad tech, but just saying, we're a business, you know, and we're a profitable business, and we're gonna keep chasing products and services that make us profitable like any other business would do. If legislation comes in the way of that, then that means that we then change our practices. So there's a part of me that was thinking, this particular case, there's no two ways about it. It's absolutely anti-competition behavior, but nobody was stopping them. Nobody got in their way. And I think it is about time that someone did, because it is very clear, you know, they used their ability to make it impossible for app developers to pay for their, to access any other payment services other than Google Play billing, which meant that then Google could take 30% of the profits from any of those app sales. And that's just clear out and out, you know, anti-competition. There's nothing that doesn't encourage a free market scenario. If what happens here is that this US legislation gets in the way of that dominance and returns us to a world where there is actually competition introduced in this part of app stores, because don't forget that there is also an outstanding claim against Apple for their app store, for their practices within their app store too. So if it reduces this marketplace to a more even playing field and allows the market to decide how they want to, what billing services they want to use and how developers should be getting compensated and rewarded, then that's a good thing, right? And so I feel as though this is one of those lawsuits that will go the full 9 yards, 10 yards? What even is that saying? Don't even know what a yard
is. It's a lot of yards. It's definitely
a lot. That's it. I feel like it will. And it's possibly got more of a chance of doing that because it's much more of a straightforward claim as well. If you think about the other lawsuits that are outstanding at the moment, like the DOJ case being brought against Google for anti-competition and dominance within Chrome, again, that from the outside looks very obvious, but it's very nuanced case that's being put forward. This is much more straightforward. So I feel like it could actually go somewhere.
Yeah. Penelope, it's, you know, Rachel's hit on a couple of points there, I think. Is this the case of the stable door being shut when the horse has already bolted, which many of these lawsuits are? And yeah, do you think this one has legs?
Yeah, I think it has a lot of legs, actually. As I was reading it and I was trying to, first of all, imagine explaining this to a jury. First of all, I was like, wow, to get jurors to sign off on a unanimous verdict on a complex topic. I mean, we've all had to, in our kind of daily lives, explain, you know, like tech and ad tech to, you know, to people who
our
might
parents.
Not deal with it on an everyday. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's not at all an easy topic to unpick and really to kind of explain. And one of the things that really did keep coming, you know, I read the verdict a couple of times. I read the sheet a couple of times. And I was trying to determine, yeah, like if Google wasn't such a successful company, would this lawsuit have even, or if, you know, the App Store wasn't so successful, would this even have arisen? You know, is it, you know, because you develop a product and you develop all the infrastructure to support the product, which is including billing. And now because you have created that ecosystem very successfully and very seamlessly in a way, and you have now prevented, you know, in a way, you know, set it up such that everyone's using it, that there are companies that now want to say, hey, I would like choice within that. And of course, I think they have been working through, and this is not the first, you know, not the first time they've requested or tried to get, you know, another payment option through, I'm very sure, before it turns into a giant lawsuit. And obviously, Google made a call that they still want to remain the only billing service within this. But really starting from that place of, if I create this whole infrastructure and I make it seamless and easy and for any app developer to put, you know, their game on and to transact and do all this great stuff, now that it's successful and am I going to have to now be forced to now share that space with other, you know, billing services? I think that's a question. It's a business question almost. And is that a monopolistic question? Because there is another choice. So it's not like this is the only app store, which is what kind of kept me back from, if this was the only app store in the universe that you could access this, then, you know, that is definitely a lot more cut and dry, that, you know, you would be limiting actual competition. But I think within this ecosystem, yes, there's definitely the limiting competition, but this is not the only ecosystem. That was what I think kept me coming back to it. And that if you join, so the example that I was kind of thinking is not exactly the same, but when you go to a casino and you change your chips in and you have to transact within a casino situation with their currency
at that cashier,
you don't get a choice of, I think someone else's, you know, bank, internal bank is more preferential to this, or the services are better, or they have more choice of, you know, whatever it is. I have no idea what goes on in casinos, but, you know, just as an analogy from a human point of view, I can't go into any casino and bring my own bank. That's the thing. I play by the house rules because they've set up this entire kind of ecosystem that supports it. So I was kind of a little bit struggling between, if you've set up the whole infrastructure, can you, you know, is it an entitlement for other businesses to say, I now want to have a part of your business? I think that's the part where I think is a bit complicated, and it feels like it's a business call and not truly a, and, you know, it's because there is another option out there. There is another app store, which is, of course, in a similar situation right now. So I think that's what I thought. And as a result, I think it's interesting that as a follow-up, what they've asked for is for the courts to also say that no one else can do such a thing, which, again, the courts have flatly said, you know, the judge, I think, in the article said, no, we're not going to do that. We don't make laws that are don't do something laws. You know, you make laws you know, you can't prevent a future potential for a crime. You can only say we don't allow these things to happen because this is, you know, against the laws of the land.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a really interesting counterpoint. I suppose, you know, the idea, yeah, I guess it's about, well, from the way that I was looking at it was thinking about the entire marketplace, like you're following your casino analogy, you know, and maybe this does hold true, but that argument works as long as you freely walked into that casino. I feel as though there was no choice if you were selling apps in an Android operating system. You had to use Google Play, but mm-hmm. to sell your apps and whatever other alternative app stores, because they couldn't make any revenue, because everybody was funneled into Google Play, just disappeared overnight. But then following your logic, Penelope, maybe the question ought not to have been, well, you know, perhaps this isn't a free market, perhaps it isn't an open market, because actually what these companies have done, both Google and Apple, is provided all of the infrastructure necessary to run and operate apps efficiently and to enable those to run and operate on their operating systems. And let's be honest, these days, those mobile phone operating systems are so sophisticated that it's not like you really, you know, I mean, it feels like it was only 4 years ago that you would routinely have problems with apps that would crash and would be a bit rubbish. Mm-hmm. And these days it never happens, right? So, you know, that's because operating systems and the app developers probably are getting better and better, but it will be because those app stores and those operating systems are requiring things of app developers to make sure that their apps are running well. All of that costs money. All of that is an infrastructure that those companies have built. And I didn't really think about it from that point of view. So maybe it's not supposed to be a free and open marketplace. Maybe it's supposed to be a service that you access because you are selling something in that environment at that time.
And then my own devil advocate, you know, being my own, I was also like, but if you were really truly believing that you wanted to create, you know, that you created this infrastructure you want, and therefore you're going to profit from it, then why is Android marketed as an open source? Everyone can join. This is
well,
true.
Quite.
So that's the point where I'm like, okay, so. If you freely walked into it and you had a choice to walk into another store, you made that choice. You play by, I guess, the rules of what you walked into. But you're also, on the other hand, marketing your store as being somehow free to everyone, open source. Anyone can build on it. But then once you've built on it and you now have invested as another company creating an app, building on this platform, you're now subject to all these other things, which you might or might not have realized when you were maybe a small baby app, and you didn't realize that you were also going to become this huge thing, and need billing and realize that you were actually buying into this whole ecosystem that you could not extricate yourself from. So again, a business decision. I would also say Epic Games is not a baby app. You know, they are not the first day in business. So that's where I find it also, this was a tough one. I do not envy anyone that had to explain this to a jury. Mm. But yes, I think it's going to be a while.
Yeah. And yet, you know, at the start of the conversation, I said, in my opinion, this was a more straightforward ruling than what will be coming down the line for the jury in the DOJ case. I don't know whether I'm right about that or not, but you've just highlighted the complexity of it. So imagine if the DOJ case is more complex. How the hell is that jury going to wrap their head around that? One thing struck me as you were just talking there, Penelope, why didn't, given the dominance that they had, and Apple should do this too, why didn't they just charge lower fees? 30% always felt like it was, you know, really money for nothing. Why didn't they just, given that every single developer had to sell apps through that billing platform, why didn't they just reduce their fees down to 15% or something? Probably would have kept people happy for a lot longer.
I mean, that's a great question. I guess it's a business decision. Again, it's a monopoly. That's what I guess everyone is concerned about. If you can charge anything, will you charge anything? And I guess they've chosen to charge anything. I mean, and I claim to know how much it costs to run the whole infrastructure. I'm sure it's expensive. I'm sure there's a lot of people think that, and I think this is one of the things which maybe the public also tends not to talk or think too much of, is that all of these miracles that we get these little apps on our phone and we download things for free, but it's powered somehow by computing and electricity and data centers and a whole lot of very expensive bells and whistles. So maybe that is the right business cost of just running it and keeping it alive. You know, I don't know. I can't say, but yeah, for now, none of us will know because it's the only show in that town.
That's right. Yeah. But I guess maybe the veracity with which Google wants to appeal and defend their claims might, you know, give us a few hints down the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, Google monopolistic titans squeezing the lifeblood out of the industry or plucky underdogs who are victims of their own success. You decide. The courts will decide. Excellent. We are going to stick with courtroom drama for our third story. Excellent. Yay. It's been a very legally focused week. We're going to talk a little bit about content moderation here. Really interesting case coming up in Texas and Florida. The IAB has joined a number of leading tech and civil society groups in a lawsuit challenging state laws which are prohibiting content moderation. The laws are looking to prohibit social media platforms from censoring users' views, placing restrictions on engaging in certain types of content moderation, coming on the back of complaints that more conservative viewpoints were being shadow banned, shut down, censored by social media platforms. Penelope, this case is absolutely fascinating that it even is a case. What do you think? Should these platforms be able to moderate content that is published on them?
Ooh, this is a topic that I just really, I think is one that we should talk about absolutely because of this, is that there is journalism and journalism is about curating, you know, some information, however you choose to curate it, and moderating if you may, and putting up a version of it that is, I would say, in the case of what we call responsible press, responsible. And that fundamental is what I think this would be affected by. Like, if you are not allowed to curate or, you know, what is going on your site as content, because I think it's all very loosely now these days called content. But I think we need to remember that. And once upon a time, not many years ago, it was journalism. And responsible journalism came with it a certain expectation of fact checking, of making sure that's responsible. You're not inciting, riots. You're not propagating fake news. And that in of how this is worded strikes me as being something that could affect editorial control to the point that I think you would then, as a source of news, you would really start to consider how are you going to sustain and how are you going to do this business or how are you going to remain in business if you had some states that are going ahead to pass laws that fundamentally restrict your ability to do that fundamental part of what is journalism. I think that's for me where I'm just really amazed that this is even a thing.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you on that. I was, when this story came up, I was fairly stunned that these laws exist. Rachel, what do you think?
I'm not surprised to hear you say that, John, as a as someone with a journalism degree. Like, you know, there is a big difference between your average piece of user-generated content and the fact-checked, accurately authored, articles that we pump out even on sites like ExchangeWire, right? Like, you know, we are they're worlds apart, and I feel like some of this debate, if you could call it that, and you know, it boiling down to legislators actually drafting legislation around this and attaching it to people's rights associated to the First Amendment in the US is all if I was going to lay the blame at someone's door, is all the fault of user-generated content, basically. And the problem here is that, and I can remember again having this debate in the office years ago, actually, if you looked at social media platforms and the amount of editorial control that they understandably want to retain over the content that goes out on their platforms, in order to prevent all of those things that you mentioned earlier, Penelope, misinformation, you know, inciting hatred, all of those sorts of things that will almost certainly dissuade advertisers from going anywhere near their platforms. Although, I don't know, look at X. Anyway, that's a whole other debate. Or Twitter. Sorry, John, we can't call it X. I'm with you. But So if we were to look at social media platforms as wanting to do all of those things, which in my view is understandable, then really they're performing the role of a publisher. And if they were actually performing the role of a publisher, they would be subjected to so many more controls and laws and restrictions than what they are currently subjected to. Their business models would look entirely different. They wouldn't be able to exercise the level of control that they do over the way that advertising is, undertaken on their site and where the revenue from that advertising goes. And it would be a whole different ball game. But that ship has sailed many years ago. And here we are in the world of social media platforms that are absolutely not categorized as publishers, yet they display a whole range of content from very, from totally factually incorrect user-generated content right through to links to, highly well-structured, well-authored, original journalist-provided content. And we've got to somehow find a way to make sure that all of that information is reasonable, is accurate, is not breaking any laws. And therefore, those social media platforms absolutely need to employ content moderators who need to be able to have enough power to do something about content that is inaccurate, wrong, insightful, even just against that social media platform's brand guidelines, whatever those, however broad those might be. We know that Twitter doesn't have any, but, the other platforms do and want very much to be able to provide an attractive environment to brands and to be able to ensure them that brand safety is upheld and that they've got some kind of control over the situation. So, yeah, I think it's user-generated content that's led us down this path and poor understanding and interpretation of the role that social media platforms are playing in society. And now that's all been scooped up by some unsurprisingly conservative states in the US that go, we don't want this because it looks a bit like censorship, and that's an infringement on people's rights under the First Amendment. And let's just make sure that we provide a platform to all of these right wing political candidates who were otherwise getting cancelled on social media platforms. That's just my cynical view there. But I feel like that's how we've gotten to where we are. I'm not sure what the solution is, but I know that it absolutely does not revolve around reducing the role and the importance and the legal scope for content moderation. That is not censorship. There's two different things. And that's another thing that upsets me, is that people are conflating these things because we're, not explaining things properly and appropriately. Censorship is a completely different ball game to content moderation. And, sitting here as I am in Singapore at the moment in the Asian region, I think, we can compare some markets in this region, right, that are heavily censored versus ones that are not. And that's not about content moderation.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That's my...
And it's going to just make... the responsible, whether it's content creators or journalists or, platforms that are creating news and information. And I'm so afraid to use the word content again, but, it's going to make doing just a normal business very complicated if this is successful. How are you going to now have to navigate that you randomly have to have in certain states a different standard or apply a different set of even, these are laws, they're not even rules, or if it's successful, it will be law in some states, in others. And, the internet is now the world. It is not, again, like publishing a regional newspaper or broadsheet, which gets distributed within, a 500-mile radius. This is out there once it's out there. So this is going to, something like this is going to have a lot of content creators really start to think about then, how will I have to do this? How am I going to navigate this? Or is there going to be some other state that passes an exact opposite law? Then what happens?
I mean, it does paint a really complex picture for people operating in the US, but that is also nothing new, right? It's the state federal sort of world of life in the US, because they have to deal with a similar sort of issue regarding data privacy, although those laws have sort of started to melt into one another across states to a certain extent, but there are still quite vast differences. And I feel like this is very politically driven, if I'm honest. And that's part of the problem with politics in the US, is it's so partisan, because states have got so much control and so much power in and of themselves. So, yeah, another example of what a mess the US is.
And I still have too much GDPR, PTSD, you know, navigating, like, what is this rule in this state, in this part of Europe versus that part of it's yeah, we don't want this to happen to the rest of all of, you know, content that's out there, everything that can be read. That's
absolutely absolutely.
One of the things that I'm a bit taken aback by for me is there seems to be a fundamental misunderstanding here of what the social media platforms are. This links into what we were saying about Google being a business. Like, they are privately owned businesses. They do not have to publish what they do not want to publish. They should have moderators. They should have editorial standards. And ultimately, they are private businesses that, you know, we may be able to use for free for whatever the, you know, the value exchange of our data is. But it baffles me that they should be told that, no, you have to put this viewpoint on your website. You know, you mustn't deplatform this person for saying vile racist things. I just think it's stunning. And yeah, I'm glad the IAB and civil rights groups are really making a stand against this from going through. It's crazy to me, totally.
Yeah. And because they're very much coming at it from the perspective of how advertisers would approach advertising on those platforms. Yeah. And I find that really fascinating too, because I don't for the life of me understand why brands are still advertising on Twitter at the moment. I mean, Elon Musk has made it very clear what he thinks about advertising and advertisers. So why are you putting your money there? I can understand that maybe it's because they feel they need to reach an audience there, but there are other options, right? And I don't know, you know, Penelope, from your point of view with some of the clients that you work here in the APAC region, do you find that some social media platforms are just rising head and shoulders above others and becoming more popular environments for brands to put their money in?
I think they're the big ones, the global platforms that dominate still dominate. However, what we see in pockets of, you know, markets in APAC with the local language that there, what we're seeing is definitely some local or kind of regional platforms becoming more and more popular. Maybe with certain groups or age groups, I think are a big one. The groups that have the propensity to try new platforms start to try new platforms. And these have been growing in the region. So there are markets which are a little bit less, I would say, Meta and Google dependent, but they still dominate. They really still do. And head and shoulders, I'm not sure whether they're truly head and shoulders above each other. It's not that anyone is at this point making such a significant, you know, none of these other maybe a little more local social media platforms. It's not that they are doing anything so significantly different other than how well that they might be using the algorithm to reach those local audiences. So that, yeah. I think they do quite significantly well. And so like some of the ones, I mean, TikTok is growing and it really leaps and bounds, but it's a very successful algorithm rather than, you know, are these other things like content moderation and all these other concepts. Is it what is getting the audience on it? No, it's a successful algorithm. It's also understanding, you know, fundamental understanding that the audience here that in a lot of these markets in our region are mobile first. You know, a lot of people's first device is not necessarily a laptop. It starts with a mobile phone. And so the way that they're consuming content is really quite different. And therefore, some of these platforms that are a lot of born of that, this era is doing a lot better with how they are, the algorithms are optimizing towards getting people really hooked on the content, and you can't stop scrolling. You just stick with it for hours and hours and hours. So those are the ones that are doing really well.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, this is, again, a fascinating discussion that we'll see how this plays out, because there's a lot of nuance to it. But yeah, just it's again baffling that these are laws that may happen, but we will see. that's going to be it for this week, for this week's legal wranglings on the MarTech podcast. Thank you very much for casting such an astute legal eye over that, Penelope. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It felt like a theme. It's a great discussion, entertaining one, and one I think that there's a lot of potential to make so much change with actually all of them, like between the Googles of the world, which have everyone's attention, you know, the Unilevers of the world, which are in everyone's kitchen. You know, there's so much potential for changing the world in some way.
Yeah, there you have it. It's been the World Changing Podcast this week.
It has. And well, thank you again, Penelope and Rachel. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening. And we will be back next week.